We're in the Oregon Convention Center for the 32nd annual meeting of the Cognitive Science Society. We're in Portland. Title of the meeting is Cognition in Flux. There's also some sessions going on, a symposium honoring 10 years of the David Rummelhart Prize in Cognitive Science. And I'm talking to a number of the Rummelhart folks, but Alison Gopnik, Professor of Psychology from UC Berkeley, is also here. We saw each other only about a week ago, and we talked about philosophical babies and all manner of things. However, it's very appropriate to talk to you about this because you've been a part of this entire cognition influx. And this year's winner, or the winner of the most recent winner of the Rummelhart Prize, Jay McClelland, who gave a talk yesterday, has a paper with some colleagues in press, I understand, in TICS, Trends in Cognitive Science, a paper on approaches to cognitive modeling, letting structure emerge, and there are some papers commenting on this, one by you, with Henry Wellman, Susan Gelman, and Andy Meltzoff. So it seemed like a very appropriate time to sort of get some sense of you about where connectionism has gone, where parallel distributed processing, which is Rummelhart and McClelland, has gone, and which will be celebrating its 25th anniversary of the two books next year. And just get some sense of the field at this point. Rather a large introduction there with many, many pieces, but dive in.
Yeah. So, let's see. So, I think that sort of, there's been this really central problem, this central tension in cognitive science, and not just in cognitive science, but in epistemology and philosophy, really going back to Plato and Aristotle, between what look like two incompatible facts about human beings and human nature and human knowledge. And in some ways, you could think of the entire history of philosophy of mind, of psychology, and of cognitive science as being this kind of dance back and forth between these two apparently incompatible facts. One fact about human beings is that they have very abstract, structured, hierarchical representations of the world around them. So they seem to know a lot about the world, and we use that knowledge to make predictions, to find our way around the world. And one of the contributions, again, going back to Plato, but most recently that Noam Chomsky made, was to emphasize just how complex and abstract and removed from immediate experience that knowledge is. So that's on the one side. On the other hand, it looks as if we actually learn that knowledge from our experience of the world. So somehow we have to go from those little bits of air at our eardrums and photons hitting our retinas to this very abstract knowledge of things like understanding a grammar or knowing that there's a three-dimensional spatial world out there or understanding the causal structure of the world or having a theory about the world. Somehow we have to get here from there or there from here. And it's always been extremely mysterious. I think in some ways the most central problem of cognitive science has been how could that happen? And there's been this, as I say, there's been this kind of dance back and forth historically between two ways of trying to solve that problem. So in a sense, the kickoff of cognitive science back in the 1960s with people like Chomsky was to say, the way you solve that problem is by saying that structure is innate. There isn't a learning problem because it isn't learned. It's something that's evolved over many centuries, and that's where the structure comes from. It isn't, even though it might look like it, it isn't derived from all this probabilistic, confusing mess that's going on out in the world. And the reaction to that, and again, as I say, there's been this kind of ping pong back and forth throughout history. The reaction to that has always been, no, it looks as if there's all this abstract structure, but really all there are specific connections between specific pieces of experience. And so if you think that 40 years ago, the pendulum was Chomsky saying that it was all there innately, 25 years ago, the new version of the empiricist alternative that came on the scene was connectionism. So connectionism said, no, there isn't really any abstract hierarchical structure. It's all just specific associations. And it had some of these ideas about how that could be implemented in the brain as well, although they were always and still are very far removed from anything that we actually know about how the brain really works. But at least in principle, they were connected to the brain. So I think that was the situation until about 10 years ago. And the back and forth between those two alternatives is exactly, in some ways, exactly the back and forth there was between Plato and Aristotle, or between Hume and Descartes, or between Kant and John Stuart Mill. Here's this abstract knowledge. how could it, we possibly get it from experience? Or on the other hand, we must get it from experience, so it can't be as abstract as it looks on the surface. And I think what's happened, so all this was unfolding sort of philosophically and theoretically and computationally. And always the aim, the thing that made cognitive science different from all of that philosophy that had gone on before, was to say, the way to answer this question is to try to figure out how could a computer, very broadly construed, what kind of computational procedures could we use that would help to solve this problem? Would those computational procedures have a lot of innate structure to begin with, or is there some way in which this structure could emerge from a specific set of associations? So we had a really wonderful new tool, the new tool that defines cognitive science, which is that we could think about computation, think about computationally precise ways of describing these problems. Okay, so 10 years ago, I think we were stuck still with the thought that the kind of computational processes that people like Jay talked about, the connectionism talked about, could only solve the problem to a very limited extent. And in parallel to all this theoretical computational work, empirical psychologists, and particularly empirical developmental psychologists like me or Andy Maltzoff or Henry Wellman or Susan Gelman, had been actually looking at, really truly looking at, well, okay, how does this happen? Well, we know it happens in the course of childhood, so what could we tell just by looking really carefully at what children know when and how they learn it? And when we did that, what appeared didn't seem to fit either of those pictures. So it looked, when we looked at children, even infants, even babies, even the very youngest children already had this kind of abstract, hierarchical, structured understanding of the world. But it didn't just stay the same. People like Steven Pinker or Noam Chomsky or Elizabeth Spelke would have said, okay, well, it's just all there. But we didn't see that either, because we saw children changing what they thought in the light of experience. So about 10 years ago, we were in a situation where empirically, we had very good evidence that what was happening was that we had, from the very beginning, we had abstract pictures of the world. We called them intuitive theories, and also that they changed with experience. And the theoretical views just couldn't accommodate that reality. So either they were, it's all there innately, or else they were the connectionist view that it's all the result of these specific associations. Now, what changed about 10 years ago was this new set of ideas, sometimes called probabilistic modeling or Bayes' nets or Bayesian learning. I like probabilistic models because it's a nice general term. A new set of ideas that actually came from the philosophy of science and the machine learning community. So in the meantime, the machine learning community, very pragmatically, was trying to make machines that would do what every baby does, go out, have experiences, get abstract knowledge from those experiences. And interestingly, they also were turning to the example of science, because of course science is a wonderful example of exactly having abstract, powerful knowledge and knowing that that knowledge comes as a result of experience. Scientific theory change, whatever else you think may be innate, you know, Einstein's theory of relativity can't be innate. Einstein's theory of relativity is right, it tells us about the world. Somehow, human beings figured it out, learned it from their experience of the world. So the new set of ideas essentially say, let's think about cognition as if it were a set of hypotheses, like scientific hypotheses, that we set out to test or to infer from the patterns of evidence around us. And that's turned out to be an extremely powerful set of ideas. And I think it's striking when we did that letter in response to TICS, those four people are all four developmental psychologists with very different specialties and very different ideas, but all of us had this sense of dissatisfaction with the theoretical positions on offer. And now I think there's a new possibility of understanding. Now, it could still be that PDP and connectionism has a role to play. The role that they have to play is that we still don't know how this process that we understand computationally, this process of producing hypotheses and testing them against evidence, we don't know how that's implemented in the brain. And it may be that something like a connectionist system could act as a kind of intermediary between the kind of abstract level of description that the Bayesian view produces and the specifics of how the brain works. But we don't know how that's going to cash out.
So all these various literatures that one has seen over the years, with different words, innatist or nativist, yeah, and empiricist and so on, the notion of innate modules, a language module, people speculating about a moral module, all sorts of modules, a dislike of a blank slate, mm-hmm. a dislike of building a mind through associationism. This has all been part of the debate, as you said.
Right.
This latest wrinkle, which derives from this connectionist, parallel distributed, emergent properties, if you like, of interacting networks. There's a new gloss on it, which you're saying is giving new horsepower to the topic, right? Are you at odds with, a standard McClellan position?
Right. Yes.
Or is it an amendment?
Right. Well, it's an interesting question about what the relationship is. And certainly, if you think that the connectionist view is all there is to say about structure of the mind, then we're at odds with it. And here's the reason. It has been an important part of that view to say there is no such thing as abstract representation, that abstract representation just somehow emerges from these distributed connections, and that it's the result of a very, very specific set of accumulations of experience. When we look at the empirical data from children, that's just not how it looks. When we look at the empirical data from children, we see children, for instance, being able to infer new hypotheses from two or three pieces of evidence. We see children providing explicit causal explanations about why it is that they believe the things that they do.
Hence your book, The Child as Scientist, making precise at that point.
Exactly.
Right?
That's right. And that's not just a theoretical view. That's what we see empirically when we actually look at what the children are doing. And over the last 10 years, again, interestingly, not in my work, I think, inspired specifically by the Bayesian work, but often just as a empirical phenomenon, we've discovered, for instance, that children can infer structure from statistical data. They do that in language. They do that about the visual world. They do that about the causal world. And there's lots and lots of papers at this very conference with specific examples of those abilities on the part of even infants. Take a bunch of statistical information or do a bunch of experiments, and you can show that the babies are making conclusions about abstract structure. And they're doing that just on one or two trials. They're not doing that. That's not a very long, painful emergent process over many, many iterations. It's happening quite quickly. And that means that the children must have, at some level of description, inductive capacities that are more powerful than the kinds of things that connectionists have talked about. And Jay and I have talked about this at great length, and what Jay will say is, well, that's, explicit propositional scientific kind of thinking. Yeah, sure, you can do that as an adult. But the important point is we see that in 9-month-olds. So it isn't just something that adult scientists do. It's something that we see from very early on. Now, a very interesting empirical question then becomes, well, what's the relationship between that kind of knowledge and that kind of learning and the kinds of phenomena that PDP or the connectionists are talking about? And I think there's a couple of possibilities. One of them, as I said, is you could think about connectionism as a kind of implementation at a lower level of this higher level, more abstract kind of reasoning. So that's one possibility. The way that in the classic example is think about your computer, and if I wanted to say why is my computer doing what it's doing, I'd say, well, it's because it's running goddamn Microsoft Word. I could also say it's because the relays are working in this particular way. Now, actually, if I'm trying to figure out what to do to fix my computer, it's not very helpful for someone when I say, why is it doing this, for someone to come to me and say, oh, well, look, it's because this, this Intel chip has just fired, right? That's not very helpful. What I want to know is at the level of the program. And one idea that's been around since the birth of cognitive science is to think about our brains as implementations of these abstract programs. And it may be that we could think about connectionism and, say, hypothesis testing as having this relationship. Another possibility is that human beings do lots of different things, and it could very well be that there's some kinds of learning that are very well described by connectionism. So an example that I give in a paper that I did about this is, think about the difference. I come from the Bay Area, and I'm a baseball fan. So think about the difference between Billy Beane and Barry Bonds. We've got lots of Bs. Okay, Billy Beane was the fantastic, brilliant manager for the Oakland A's. And what he does when he makes decisions is he reads things, he looks at the data, he makes inferences, he draws generalizations, he discovers that stealing second base is actually a terrible idea, even though people think that it is, and then he draws inferences as a result, and he wins ball games. Now think about what Barry Bonds does. Barry Bonds does a little of that, but mostly what Barry Bonds does is he stands up at the plate, the ball goes over the plate, he swings at it, he misses, or he hits, and he does it over and over and over and over again, and he gets better and better and better and better as he does it. If you asked him, he would have no idea what was going on. He couldn't, you know, outside of some very general things, he couldn't explain to you what it is that he's doing. It takes thousands and thousands of trials to get it right. Now, it could be that what's happening in human beings is that we have both those capacities. We have the kind of learning capacities that someone like Jay would describe, where we do something over and over and again, and we implicitly build up structure and abilities. But we also have these capacities for inference, for deduction, for science. And we have them not just as scientists, but as the very, very, very youngest babies. And there's another point about this, which is, you know, you mentioned the blank slate. Again, there's been a traditional distinction where the nativists all were the ones who thought there was something there to begin with, and the empiricists thought it was a blank slate to begin with. Actually, I think what the new Bayesian view says is very interesting and much closer to what we see empirically, which is it's not a blank slate. There's lots of material there to begin with. But that's not the end of the story. That's just the beginning of the story, as in science.
All right, so can I just interject there and say, to put this in really crass language, what are the built-ins then, based on that? I mean, I think back to the Human Quest series that I did that you were involved in, and that René Baillargeon was involved in. René's here as well. Filming you working with very small children, or René doing that magic show where the puppet goes across and then it reappears somewhere else. And there's obviously a response from very wee kiddies who you must infer are thinking, where did that go? And why didn't it track across there, and so on and so forth. So are you saying that, although not a blank slate, if there is anything built in, what we have built in are, if you like, engines, networks that can do procedures and build inferences and so on, but not specific modules that do things?
Right. Well, here's what I think. I think it's stronger than saying there are just engines. It's not different from saying there are modules, and here's why. I think what we have to begin with are first theories, first hypotheses. So I think what René's work has shown, what Andy Meltzoff's work has shown, what other people have shown, is that we come with some assumptions about what's likely to be true about the world. So we're born believing certain kinds of things. I think it's quite fair to say we're born believing certain kinds of things about people, about language, about the world around us. But here's the important thing. The Chomskyan view was that innateness was about constraints on the final structure. So on Chomsky's view, it didn't really even matter to Chomsky what you were born with in the sense of what was there when you were came out of your mother's womb. What mattered was there were some things that you couldn't learn. There were some things that couldn't change. There were strong constraints on the mind and on understanding. And that's the part that's different. So the Bayesian view is you start out with these very high probability hypotheses about the world. You go out and you get evidence. You alter and revise and change what you think in the light of that evidence. Then you test it. Then you get more evidence. Otto Neurath, who was a great philosopher of science, had a lovely phrase, which is that knowledge is a boat that we rebuild as we sail in it. And that's exactly the Bayesian view. So exactly the Bayesian view is we're never just floundering around in the water. We start out in a boat, but, and this is where the difference is from, say, a modularity view or a core knowledge view or a Chomskyan view, we rebuild. So we're in the boat from the very beginning, and as we're trying to negotiate the waters, we say, oh, wait a minute, this would be a better spar, let's revisit this. And by the time we get to be an adult, we may have almost nothing left of the ideas that we started out with when we were babies. But this gives, you can see why from an evolutionary point of view, this is a much more powerful picture, because this is the picture, I think, that's the picture of us as human beings, which is this incredible capacity to go out and be in any environment and figure out what that environment is all about. No. But it's important to think of it as a process of revision, not just a process of learning. So we start out with hypotheses and the capacity, learning capacities, that are very well designed to let us alter and change and revise those hypotheses, sometimes in fairly radical ways. So that's the thing that I think is the powerful idea in learning. And that's the thing that we're starting to get a computational handle on, which we didn't have before.
A major influence on Quine as well?
Yes, absolutely. Okay. And in fact, that quote is the quote that's at the beginning of Quine's Word and Object.
Yeah, okay. So, if you have this model then, what's the difference between saying, okay, given the Bayesian Bayesian position, what's wrong with the notion that connectionist structures, PDP structures, are in fact the things that are implementing these
right.
online changes that are going on all the time? And how is that different from computational neuroscience anyway? And for somebody out there thinking, is this just some sort of little turf fight?
Right.
I mean, what are the essences, you
right.
see?
So the essence is, should you think about people, and especially babies and infants, as having hypotheses or theories about the world?
Yes.
So is that a good way of thinking about them? Is that a good description of what human beings are like?
And indeed, that was my next question, mm-hmm. because what you just said so eloquently, I think people would, if they heard that, would say, oh, yeah, that's what I do. But they don't think that that's what they do
mm-hmm.
on a routine, regular basis. Now, if people, I'm just wondering, if people thought, knew that that's what they were doing, people in power, people who can make decisions, people in political positions, might this be a different world if they were acutely aware of how their minds worked? Which leads me to this question, as we all sit in here, discussing cognitive science, is there, and this is a continuation of your problem, a model of the mind? You'd think that people in Washington, say, who are implementing education policy, would think that these policies would be at least in harmony
right.
with some model of the mind that all these kids must possess, right? Wrong?
Right. Well, one of the things that's appealing about the Bayesian view is that it gives you a sense of a kind of continuity between the kind of learning that children are just spontaneously, naturally doing, even when they're very young babies. The kind of experimentation, for instance, that they're doing. There's some lovely work about the way that children can actually do experiments to find out more about the world, and the kind of science that we're teaching them later on. And I do think the picture that we often have in education is that there's some body of knowledge that, you know, some set of experts has somewhere, and our job is to somehow cram it into the resistant brains of the young.
Yeah.
And the view that comes out of cognitive science, and I think this is very generally true, even across some of the arguments about the details in cognitive science, the view that comes out of cognitive science is that there's incredible continuity between what we do naturally and spontaneously, especially as young children, and what we do in enterprises like science. So that gives a very different picture. So in a sense, what you think about education then is that it's a way of exploiting or allowing these, a better way perhaps of putting it is, it's a way of allowing these very fundamental, deep, natural instincts for curiosity, for induction, for learning to flourish rather than a process of somehow getting children to do something which they're naturally not at all inclined to do.
This model also gives you, obviously, inherent in this model is the capacity for the realization of individual personalities and skills, and
mm-hmm.
because they're that machine is going to develop in different ways depending upon what the inputs are and so on. There's less of a rigid sense to the.
And I think it's important to say that if you have the view that that babies, for instance, are sensitive to empirical evidence about what's going on around them from the time they're very young, that means that the kind of experiences that you give children are relevant. They're significant. They're important. But they're also not important, you know, if it's not a blank slate, it's not a slate that a grown-up comes and stamps either. It's that, again, this is part of the reason why we've so often used the analogy of science. If you think about the way that scientists find out about the world, and after all, science is the greatest example we know of the human capacity to find out about the world. It does it through processes of induction, of exploration, of test, of curiosity, of revision. And those are the things that I think those qualities of science that are so important are qualities that we could exploit in education as well. And I think in particular, I mean, it's interesting because if you think about, you know, those adults in Washington, it may be, and again, I think this is very consistent with the Bayesian picture, that as you become an adult, one of the ideas is that you have lots of different hypotheses, and essentially what you're doing is balancing the probability of those hypotheses. So you start out with some hypotheses that have a very high probability. You get evidence that means, nah, they're not so likely, and something that's very unlikely can become much more likely. Now, one of the consequences of that is as you become an adult and your central views become more and more well confirmed, it gets to be harder and harder to change them. So in some ways, I think and I think this is kind of a lovely irony, in some ways our nine-month-olds look more like scientists than our senators do, right? Or maybe even our senior distinguished scientists do. Because, of course, as a senior distinguished scientist, we become deeply embedded in the things that have worked for us before and that we think highly of, and we're all rather painfully aware of the fact that the only way the change is going to come is from our students and our graduate students. I think there's something like that that's true for the human species as well, that it's our children who don't, there's some advantages to not yet being very sure about what it is that you know, and you see those advantages in children.
This is interesting because as we've talked about this before, that one of the things that we try and do on the Science Network is to try and convey some sense of how science is done. And we've had that conversation about a public that seems to think that science is supposed to deliver certitude,
right?
Whereas in fact, in the doubt business, not the belief business. Now, obviously you can't take that too far to a completely relativistic position where, oh, scientists don't know anything and it's changing all the time and there aren't any facts, or nobody knows what a fact is and everybody has their own facts and so on and so forth. Nevertheless, somewhere in that territory, conveying how the science is done and how it is this tentative stepping forward on rocks across a stream and sometimes falling off and having to go back and find another way around and this rock didn't work. That sort of a tentative note, if people could get more comfortable with that,
right?
Which is the point Ken Robinson makes when he talks about kids in classes. I mean, they're quite happy to be wrong or make fools of themselves. They're not entrenched.
Right.
And they don't have major reputations to lose and so on and so forth. So that kind of naive way, it could indeed be what you're saying, is closer to the truth of how science is done.
Right. Well, I mean, I think again, an interesting point that comes out of the Bayesian work is that there's one of these other tragic tensions in human existence, which is that if you want to learn, right, then having lots of hypotheses, being very open to disconfirmation, being able to think about different kinds of possibilities, that's really important, in fact, crucial. If you want to act, if you want to do something, then you're kind of stuck, because if you actually have to make a decision, then you have to make a decision based on some hypothesis. You'd be crippled if you sat there trying to work through all the possible hypotheses. So there's a real tension in the system, I think, between on the one hand wanting to be open to revision, and on the other hand, at some point you actually have to do something. You have to make a decision. You have to say, all right, we're going to, you know, cut down on carbon emissions, or we're not going to cut down on carbon emissions. And I think one of the things that you see in development is that you seem to have this early period. I mean, it's no coincidence that babies and children are as dependent and useless as they are. In other words, what they're doing is considering all these possibilities. They're not very good at just saying, here's the right one that we should actually act on. So to be fair, I think that part of what happens is that childhood, science, learning, there's all these aspects of human nature when what we're doing is exploring possibilities and trying to learn. But there are also aspects of human nature, which are things like planning, acting, doing policy, where we somehow have to decide which of all those alternatives to implement. And I think part of what happens is that it would be that the pressure on the part of, say, the leader, right, to say, all right, guys, troops, this is the right answer, I'm sure, follow me, you can sort of see where that pressure comes from. And it's a really important problem for society, and I don't know how to solve it. How do you get policymakers who have enough confidence and enough executive skill to say, all right, this is the way we're going to go. Let's go ahead and do it. How do you balance that against what we also know about humans, which is, and I could be wrong.
Well, but, and how do you balance that with, this is the way we're going, and then for very good reasons, changing your mind and saying, that was the wrong direction,
right.
This is the way we should be going, without being accused of doing flip-flops. The same thing with scientists who built laboratories based on a hypothesis that they have developed, in which they're very invested, and there are investments in them from granting agencies, to sort of look at that and say, I was wrong. That's really tough to do that.
Well, as I say, I think sort of the way that evolution solves it, and in some ways we've reproduced this in our social institutions by having students and graduate students, is to say, all right, you know, the next generation are the ones who are going to, you know, I hope that's not completely true. I certainly have changed my mind about things in the course of my career. But very often the form that will take is that then there's a new generation that's going to carry on, that will have the capacity to move around in a way that us old fogies find more difficult.
One last quick thing. One of the things I was talking to Roger Shepherd yesterday, and we'll talk some more. He's very interested in the whole nature of morality.
Mm-hmm.
And I know this is something that interests you as well. I saw a piece by Paul Bloom recently on the moral life of babies. I think we talked about this to some extent before, but do you think it's interesting that kind of these kind of issues like morality, and again, John Brockman had a group of people over at the farm recently, Sam Harris and various people talking about these issues, that they've come, they're in gatherings like this now rather than in philosophical or in churches.
So it's interesting. A lot of the work that's the Bayesian work has come out of a collaborative that I've been the PI on, that the McDonald Foundation has run. That's the McDonald Foundation Causal Learning Collaborative that's been operating for about 7 years, I guess, which has been bringing together people from machine learning and philosophy and developmental psychologists. So the last 7 years or so, we've been meeting on a regular basis, and I think a lot of the ideas about this in developmental psychology have come out of that group. So now we're trying to decide what to do next. And one of those really nice things, we had a meeting that we thought would be very contentious about, well, what would everyone like to do next? And it turned out almost everyone in the room was doing something about moral development, social understanding, normative, what philosophers call normative questions. Not just what is, not just what do we think, but what ought we to think? How ought we to live? And it turned out that one of those nice zeitgeist coincidences, almost all of us had been thinking about that and doing things about that. And I think there's great hope for the thought that we can, and if you think about morality, it raises exactly the same kinds of puzzles that cognition raises, in the sense that the view that, you know, those people that John Brockman was talking to have, or that Paul Bloom tends to express, which is, okay, there's this innate evolutionary moral grammar or basis for morality that's a constraint, and then there's some other thing, reason, that comes in later on. I think that view has the same kinds of problems that the knowledge view has. But if you think about morality as being rooted in very fundamental capacities that we see even in infants, capacities for empathy, capacities for altruism, capacities for a kind of intimate concern, but also is capable of revision, alteration, change in the light of new things we see about what makes for a thriving human life or what makes for a thriving human society, right down to, you know, traffic rules, which are obviously not something that anybody ever had as an evolutionary, as something that was evolutionarily innate. Everything from the fact that we can invent traffic rules to the fact that we can accept gay marriage. All of those are examples where our capacity to revise our immediate intuitions is absolutely crucial and central, and in some ways I would argue more central to our moral development than the fact that we start out with some evolutionarily embedded moral structure. And again, exactly as if you think about the science case, right, I think what the cognitive science has told us is it's neither the case that somehow our scientific knowledge is all just the result of our evolution, but nor is it up for grabs. There's a sense in which we revise and change, and when we revise and change, we get better, our scientific theories get better, and we can now say something computationally about what that means and how that's possible. I think a very similar thing would be really exciting in the moral field, if we could say it's not just that we have some innate moral module. And it's not just that it's all just socially up for grabs, but that there's a sense in which there's a real direction and that we could capture, a sense in which we revise and change our moral views in a way that actually enables us to do better than we did before. That would be a fantastic thing for cognitive science and psychology to actually have. And maybe the fact that we've got some tools that have been allowing us to do this in the cognitive realm, where we can say, here's how we get from our innate capacities to this capacity to revise, and here's why it actually makes things better. Here's why, even though the scientific theories, it's this paradox that the scientific theories are always going to turn out to be wrong, and we know that to begin with, but they're always going to be less wrong than the ones that preceded them. That if we could articulate that in the realm of the moral, I think that would be a really great accomplishment. So that's why that will be the next challenge for our group of computationalists and developmental psychologists.
And we'll talk some more about that next time. Lovely to see you again. Okay. Thanks, Alison.
Okay, thanks, Roger.